17th, 1999, 1 p.m., hearing room 174.
Good afternoon. Chair Butler is not here today. He may be here. We don't know. He was called away for a meeting, and so he graciously asked me to chair the meeting today. And so we will open a hearing today, a public hearing, on House Bill 2525, and would like to call our good friend and colleague, Representative Shetterly, to come forward and share his thoughts with us on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Krupp? I'll have to get one of those for Representative Werbelow up in the Judiciary Committee. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of you for House Bill 2525. You have a two-page summary of the bill. I have been trying to keep members informed about the bill as it has progressed. I'll be very brief about it. And then just explain a little bit about the process. House Bill 2525 would establish a hearing officer panel attached to the Employment Department, and the purpose of the panel will be to provide hearing officers to conduct contested case administrative hearings for the agency listed in the bill. That is, the bill in Section 9 actually excludes certain agencies, boards, and commissions. Those that are not excluded by the bill are actually then included. And this is designed to get at a problem. I will tell you, the legislature has been struggling with for 20 years, at least 20 years, and the legislature has met opposition from time to time with governor's offices, with Department of Justice in its efforts to do this, and it is to create an independent forum to provide for fair hearings and fact findings in contested case proceedings when administrative agencies are taking action against a regulated a citizen or a regulated business under the authority of the agency. Under current law, your typical scenario, and it does vary from agency to agency, but I'll give you a fairly standard scenario. Under current law, if you are a person or a business regulated by a state agency, and the agency makes a determination through its enforcement and investigative proceedings that you have violated a state law that it is charged with regulating or an administrative rule, the agency issues some administrative action against you. Typically, that would be an order directing maybe a fine, it may be a suspension of a license, it may be a revocation of a license, it may be your ticket to your livelihood, depending on the agency. It may be the license that determines whether your restaurant or business stays open or closes. Under current law, your opportunity to contest that is to request a hearing, and that hearing is conducted either in front of an employee of the agency that has already made the determination against you that you have violated the law or administrative rule, or it is made in some cases by the director or by the commission itself of the agency, or by hearing officers that may not be employed but are under contract with the agency. And so, in effect, I've likened it to the situation being out driving on the roads and being stopped by a police officer and having your ticket issued to you and asking for a court date and going to court to find out that the judge works for the police department. And that's very much how our administrative contested case hearings process works right now. That raises an issue of at least the appearance of fairness and independence in the manner in which these contested cases are conducted. But it actually gets, I think I would say, worse in that the current law does not provide any effective barrier in what we call ex parte communication. So that if you have a hearing officer, let's say, that is employed by an agency, and you go to the agency and you have your hearing in front of this hearing officer, you don't know this, but either before the hearing or very possibly after the hearing, there may be contacts with that hearing officer made by another person from the agency, perhaps a director or an assistant director, or there may be contact between the hearing officer and its attorney in the Department of Justice that appeared at the hearing asking or requesting advice on how the hearing officer ought to rule in the case. These contacts all take place off the record, and you as a party to the proceeding have no notice that they are taking place, nor do you have any opportunity to respond to these ex parte contacts. And in fact, there is no provision at this point for those to effectively be disclosed. Then, even after that, when the hearing officer prepares, in most cases, what would be a proposed order in the case, before that order goes out, it goes to the agency's director or whoever at the director's office is in charge of looking at these things. And it has one more stop. It has to get to that director's office. It has to pass muster through the director's office before that order goes out. So even though the director or that person in the director's office did not attend the hearing, did not see the witnesses, did not evaluate the evidence in the course of the hearing, they have the final say in how the case is going to be decided in which you are contestant. It's kind of a stacked deck when you are a participant contesting an agency's action against you. That might be okay if we had meaningful judicial review of agency proceedings, but we don't. Because under current law, if you appeal an agency action against you, now the order has finally been entered and it did not go in your favor, so you appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals, the standard of review at the Court of Appeals is what's called the substantial evidence test. So basically what the court is going to look at is whether or not there is evidence in the record to support the agency's findings. And if the court finds evidence in the record, they're not going to weigh whether they would have made the same choice, made the same decision. If there is evidence in the record to support the agency's determination, you lose and the agency wins. So we do not have a meaningful opportunity, basically, to ask the court for an independent examination of the agency's action because of the standard of review that's based on substantial evidence. This bill, again, addresses all of those features of the current administrative hearings process. It provides for an independent forum for a factual hearing to determine what the facts were in the case. There has been a lot of discussion about, from some agencies, and I know the real estate folks are here today, some agencies very much want to keep their own director or their own commission, their own hearing officers, and I say some agencies and also some regulated constituencies, because they're concerned about this loss, what they call the loss of expertise. They have an expert, they want the expert making the determination. I'm here to say that House Bill 2525 does not affect the ability of an agency to apply its expertise in determining matters of law or application or interpretation of policy. Those are within the purview of the agency, and they will remain in the purview of the agency. What the hearings under House Bill 2525 will do will provide an opportunity for you to go and present your case in front of an independent hearing officer that does not have a stake in the facts. A hearing officer is going to determine what the facts were, and the agency should not have a stake in the facts either, because the facts are the facts. The facts don't require an application of expertise. When we had this hearing 2 years ago in the Judiciary Committee upstairs, I remember Justice Gillette from the Supreme Court, who has extensive experience both in the Department of Justice and now as a justice in the Supreme Court in administrative law, saying that there is a great overstatement of the necessity of expertise in the determination of facts in contested cases. The facts are the facts, and they can be decided by an independent fact finder, which is what this bill will provide. That fact finder, then, under this bill, will have the opportunity to prepare a proposed order that says, based on the facts, I think the case ought to come out this way. That proposed order, then, under this bill, goes to the agency, just as it does under standard common practice now. And the agency at that point has the ability still to say, well, we differ with the hearing officer in your interpretation of the law or your application of our policy. We're going to change what you have done. That much can still be done. The agency retains the right to make those kind of determinations. What this bill does, though, that's significant, is it requires that those changes made by the agency must be done on the record so that people know when it's happened. And it's not been something that's happened behind the closed doors or off the record. So the agency retains the ability to change a hearing officer's conclusions of law, interpretation of policy, those kinds of things that are within the scope of an agency's expertise. It only requires that the agency show on the record what they've done so that the parties know. It opens it shines the light on the process, and it instills confidence in that. The limitation on the agency has to do with the facts, and that the agency will not have carte blanche authority to change facts. Under this bill, when we're talking about historic facts, that is, a fact, a determination that an event did or did not occur, or that a condition or circumstance, is that the right word? Okay. So if the hearing officer determines that something did or did not happen, a historical fact, was the light red, was the light green, what was the temperature of the water, did the person say yes or did the person say no, those kind of historic findings of fact, or if the issue is whether a circumstance or status existed, those facts will be binding on the agency unless the agency can show that the hearing officer that there was not a preponderance of the evidence to establish those in the record. We want to protect the hearing officer's findings of fact here from what I've talked about before in current practice, where it is possible for the agency or for the director to change the facts even without having participated in the hearing. So we have built in some protection for purely factual and historic factual findings, but otherwise the agency retains the right to change the application of law, the application or interpretation of policy, and those kinds of issues within its expertise. The only requirement under the bill, again, being that the agency identify on the record what it's doing so everybody knows. If an agency does change a fact, if they determine that the hearing officer blew it and that the light wasn't red but the light was green, then that issue, when it goes up on appeal, can be determined anew by the Court of Appeals. You really do get a new hearing, basically, or a new look at that issue of fact, since that would be a material fact critical to the outcome of the case. Just a couple of other things about this that are, I think, are important. Standards and training. This bill addresses the need to make certain that we basically raise all the boats to the same level and that we intentionally support a professional cadre of hearing officers in this state that are trained to do the work that we are expecting them. It directs the chief hearing officer to implement a program of standards and training to do just that, to create a strong professional class of hearing officers in this case. It also authorizes the hearing officer to contract with hearing officers outside of the panel if particular needs are required, if there are indeed issues of need of actual particular expertise in the case, or if the workload is such, it authorizes the chief hearing officer to contract outside the agency. I will tell you that this bill is a substantial reworking of House Bill 2948 that passed last session by wide margins, both Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate. I think the Senate vote was 20-3, as I recall, last session. It was vetoed after the session closed. I met with the governor before the veto, and he pledged to work with me and the other proponents of the bill during the interim. We did that. We met on about a monthly basis with a work group that represented the governor, represented legislative interests, represented the Department of Justice and a number of agencies, hearing officers, and representatives of private business regulated by agencies. The bill that you have before you is a product of that work group. It is a carefully crafted and very delicate compromise of interests. I can tell you that there are pieces in there that I would change if I had the ability to do it. And there are pieces in there that, if changed, I know the governor would be pleased to veto the bill. And so I am encouraging you to take this opportunity to act on the bill that we have before us and keep in mind the adage that sometimes the perfect is the enemy of the good. We have been working at this. I say we, the legislature, has been trying to do this for 20 years. We almost did it last session. We had the bill. We got the veto. We are back with you. The governor's office is on board. The Department of Justice is on board. The Employment Department is prepared to take this on. They are able to do it. The stars are aligned, and I think that this is the session that we either must strike and do this, or I question whether the legislature will be able to resurrect this. Again, I emphasize to you the critical importance of the action that we take at this time. I leave it to your good officers to work this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Lane, some agencies have been included, some excluded. What sort of rule of thumb was applied when you excluded some of them. I don't know if you did it, but
I'll tell you, that's there are you've got some agencies in the list of excluded agencies. I'll say PUC, for instance. We just didn't want to go there. Their hearings, their proceedings are just too weird. They deal with issues, and frankly, they were not a particular concern to the groups to put this bill together. Workers' comp is one that obviously has its own body of law that is separate and distinct substantially from what most other agencies do. In large part, I think the greatest number of excluded agencies are agencies that primarily do not do contested case proceedings under the Administrative Procedures Act, or do not do a significant volume of them. There are agencies in that excluded group that haven't done a contested case hearing in the last 4 or 5 years, and don't remember when the last one is that they did. It's interesting, if you look back at 2948, last session, our effort there was to create what I said then was a stable of agencies that would give us a critical mass to move forward with this project and determine how it works, to show that it can succeed. And so we picked and chose agencies to move into the bill and make subject to the hearing officer panel. In this case, it was pretty much the directive of the governor's office that we were going to go the opposite direction and say we will assume that just about everybody is in, but then carve out these exceptions. And those exceptions are the process of the work group. And so I think each one has its own particular
rule of thumb.
No overarching rule of thumb, except for a couple of things that I've mentioned.
Understand that higher ed, which really does have a variety of appeals at many different levels, is going to be asking for an amendment which would specify how this applies and how it doesn't apply. What you're thinking about higher ed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe. I think the amendment that I have that was proposed to me for higher ed was to basically exclude what they described as intra-campus hearings, student conduct, those kinds of things that occur on campus, and also I think on-campus personnel kinds of issues. And I have no problem with that. Again, if I had listed the top 30 agencies and types of proceedings that I wanted to capture by this bill, that would not have been on the list. So I don't have any problem with accommodating that. Understand, of course, that there are lots
in for community colleges.
I don't know. I haven't heard from community colleges. Lots of agencies. The typical chorus of acclaim for this bill from agencies is, hey, it's a great bill, but our agency is different, and we need to get out. The governor's office has pretty well, we have a letter from the governor's office that says that the bill, as it came out of Judiciary Committee, the governor will sign and support. I take that by inference to be a pretty strong suggestion that too many amendments that affect substantially the makeup of the panels, the agencies, or the structure of the bill will jeopardize the bill. And I have disciplined myself to take very much the same position the governor's office has with not only agencies but constituencies of agencies that have come to me to be excluded. This does represent a very fragile coalition between the legislature and the governor's office at this point. And I will credit the governor's office with having been protective of the group that's in here and the group that's excluded. They've done their job, and I have pretty well taken the same line. I've advocated for the construction contractors, for instance, to be excluded from the bill. I thought they made a good case to be excluded. The governor's office made its own determination that they should be in. I had to decide what's more important to me, the construction contractors board or the bill. And clearly, with the history of the effort that we have made to get here, the bill to me is more important. And so I get back to when I say that sometimes the perfect is the enemy of the good. I would take CCB out if I could, but I would rather have the bill than risk the bill by taking CCB out and then giving the governor the opportunity to say he will change the deal and give us another veto. And I don't doubt that that would be a likely outcome.
Lane, what is the ultimate positive benefit of making this change in the statute?
Sure. Mr. Chair, the ultimate positive benefit in making the change is that it clearly sends a message that we are going to hold our agencies to a standard of fairness in their enforcement proceedings that we expect when we go to court,
that we expect in our other dealings, that we don't want a stacked deck. We want to have fairness in the process. We want to have impartiality in the critical part of the process that finds the facts on which the decisions are going to be made. To me, that is absolutely critical. We don't have that now in Oregon. The agencies that enforce the actions ultimately drive the hearing process and through that have the ability to shape the outcome. To their credit, most agencies are determined to be honorable and fair in the actual product. But there is certainly a perception, and we heard this loud and clear last session, about this lack of separation between enforcement and hearings, and in fact some instances of outright actual interference with fairness in the process. This was received last session, and I think it will be again this session, as a strong vote for good government and fairness in process. Again, understanding these are not critical. They're not criminal cases. We're not sending people to prison, but these are cases where you've got somebody's livelihood in many cases on the line. Their ability to practice their profession, their ability to operate their restaurant, their business, whatever it may be. And we owe it to those people to accord them the same level of fairness in the administrative process that we would expect in other avenues. And I will say, too, that just I haven't mentioned, but I think 24 other states at this point have this similar type of central administrative hearings process. I was at a conference of national administrative law judges in November. I met with the chief administrators from a number of other states. This works well in those other states. And in fact, one of the reasons we started with 2948 last session by beginning with a fairly small group was the experience is that once this gets established and once that agencies and regulated constituencies, develop a comfort level with this, they request actually to move in to the process because it does give them credibility too. The agencies understand that the hearings function is being separated from them, so they don't have it doesn't look like something that was dictated by them. It gives them some cover, gives them some protection in the process, but ultimately works to make their process more credible. It'll help all of us.
Are there any further questions of the representatives?
Yes. Lane, do you know about its cost effectiveness? Is it going to be a more expensive way of doing it, less expensive? What do you think?
Obviously, there's going to be some. I haven't seen the fiscal on this thing as I've seen this morning. Obviously, there are going to be some budget numbers getting this thing started. I think it has some prospect of at least achieving cost neutrality and in fact, possibly saving money in a couple of ways. One of these is the ability to utilize hearing officers for more than one agency through this panel, so that you may have an agency that. Has hearing officers in its employment and experiences downtime, so the caseload isn't very active, and those hearing officers may have some time on their hands. This will give us the ability to utilize those hearing officers to their full efficiency, so that if they're not hearing OLCC hearings today, they can be hearing Department of Transportation hearings, or they can be hearing some other agency cases. So I think it will utilize our hearing officers more effectively, also on remote hearings, so that if we're sending somebody to Lakeview, it's not one agency sending their hearing officer to Lakeview to hear that agency's hearings while the next week another agency hearing officer goes to Klamath Falls for its hearings. But this panel will be able to send these hearing officers out to these remote hearings to hear a wide variety of scheduled agency hearings, all of these at one time. So I think there will be good utilization there. Also in the bill, I've not made a big deal of it, but I think it potentially, based on what I've heard from other states, potentially can actually bring some revenue into the state because the bill authorizes the central panel to contract with local governments who do not have their own hearing officers. And in fact, the panel rate, it will probably be less than what many cities and counties pay attorneys that do their private hearings at this point. It will give counties and cities and other local districts the ability to contract with the hearing officer panel to conduct their hearings. And so in that case, we'll bring revenue into the state as this panel becomes established and gains credibility.
If Well, no further questions, Representative Shetterly. We thank you, sir, for coming and sharing this bill with us, and we want to thank you for getting away with not having to put any money in the pink piggy bank.
And I want to know, what is this?
I am remiss, and I will share with the audience, if you don't know, Chair Butler has a rule in this committee that if you use an acronym and do not correct yourself with the entire name of the agency or whatever, given that it's not obscene, you owe us 25 cents, and that 25 cents will go to the American Cancer Society. So you are all forewarned. There are no excuses.
I'm really relieved that we were talking about the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, I appreciate it. I'm going, we've got Senate Bill 50 upstairs as this year. I will run up and conduct my meeting. If you need anything more from me, please contact the committee room, and I will be glad to come down and rebut whatever I need to rebut.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
We have a number of individuals signed up to testify. I would, however, like to invite Chip Lazenby from the governor's office forward first to share his thoughts on this issue.
Chip, welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm legal counsel to Governor John Kitzhaber. I think the fragility of the agreement that we have in this bill is reflected in large part by the different characterizations that Representative Shetterly and I often place on the concepts that are involved here. Let me start on a positive note by saying what I think the most positive aspects of this are. One, I think we will see at the end of this four-year pilot project, and it is going to be a pilot project, we'll see the beginnings of a professionally trained cadre of hearings officers throughout state government. We also will see more standardization of contested case hearings throughout state government, even more so than is presently the case under the Attorney General's Model Rules for Administrative Procedures, or APA, type of hearings. There are some elements of this, though, to speak on the other side of this. It was a very widely supported bill last time in the legislature, but a number of state agencies had serious concerns about its impact. The chair asked earlier about the fiscal impact of this. Last time we were looking at one projection that showed $3 million in savings in the coming biennium. We were looking at other projections that were showing it would cost $12 million just to set up a department. This is on House Bill 2948 last time. There was also a fair amount of inability to determine who was actually correct on some of the major underlying controversies under the bill. For instance, Representative Shetterly mentioned that there's kind of a stacked deck approach that goes on in administrative hearings because the hearings officer works for the agency or has a particular slant on the way the agency works. This makes sense if you continue to think of these contested case hearings as trials, as jury trials, for either for a civil case or a criminal case, when they are not that at all. What they are is a process for the agency to sort out facts to decide how to apply its policies. It is not, as some people in our work group and in testimony last time tried to characterize it, as an opportunity to place the agency on trial. And from that standpoint, they are different, and it is different. It's not the type of thing where you're starting out to prove something that's wrong. But there is this perception out there that if the person who's ordering the facts is on the payroll of the agency that you have a beef with, that somehow the facts as you portray them are going to get skewed somehow. So in an effort to clear up that perception, one of the things we do in this bill is we shift responsibility for these hearings officers out of the agency to question. Another thing that we do in the bill that I think is very important that came out of the work group is that we take all board members and commission members out of the business of conducting these hearings. Let's assume that Representative Leonard and Representative Hansen and I, to be sort of unipartisan about it, are a part of a board and commission, and I'm conducting a contested case hearing with an individual that has a gripe with one of the agency's policies. My proposed order then would go back to my board members, who all likewise are conducting contested case hearings, and there's a perception there that the three of us, in an effort to consolidate our policy, might not give a fair hearing to the individual hearings that are out there in front of us. This takes the individual board members out of the fray of a contested case hearing and puts them in a position where they do review the record, they do apply the agency's or the board's or the commission's policies to the findings that are presented to them, so that they appear and have actually a less adversarial position as far as that's concerned. I also want to stress that this is a 4-year pilot project, and that the first 2 years of this pilot project are going as to case hearings throughout state government, even more so than is presently the case under the Attorney General's model rules for administrative procedures or APA type of hearings. There are some elements of this, though, to speak on the other side of this. It was a very widely supported bill last time in the legislature, but a number of state agencies had serious concerns about its impact. The chair asked earlier about the fiscal impact of this. Last time we were looking at one projection that showed $3 million in savings in the coming biennium. We were looking at other projections that were showing it would cost $12 million just to set up a department. This was on House Bill 2948 last time. There was also a fair amount of inability to determine who was actually correct on some of the major underlying controversies under the bill. For instance, Representative Shetterly mentioned that there's kind of a stacked deck approach that goes on in administrative hearings because the hearings officer works for the agency or has particular slant on the way the agency works. This makes sense if you continue to think of these contested case hearings as trials, as jury trials, either for a civil case or a criminal case, when they are not that at all. What they are is a process for the agency to sort out facts to decide how to apply its policies. It is not, as some people in our work group and in testimony last time tried to characterize it, as an opportunity to place the agency on trial. And from that standpoint, they are different, and it is different. It's not the type of thing where you're starting out to prove something that's wrong. But there is this perception out there that if the person who is ordering the facts is on the payroll of the agency that you have a beef with, that somehow the facts as you portray them are going to get skewed somehow. So in an effort to clear up that perception, one of the things we do in this bill is we shift responsibilities for these hearings officers out of the agency's discretion. Another thing that we do in the bill that I think is very important that came out of the work group is that we take all board members and commission members out of the business of conducting these hearings. Let's assume that Representative Leonard and Representative Hansen, and I have to be sort of unipartisan about it, are a part of a board and commission, and I'm conducting a contested case hearing with an individual that has a gripe with one of the agency's policies. My proposed order then would go back to my board members, who all likewise are conducting contested case hearings, and there's a perception there that the three of us, in an effort to consolidate our policy, might not give fair hearing to the individual hearings that are out there in front of us. This takes the individual board members out of the fray of a contested case hearing and puts them in a position where they do review the record, they do apply the agency's or the board's or the commission's policies to the findings that are presented to them so that they appear and have actually a less adversarial position as far as that's concerned. I also want to stress that this is a four-year pilot project, and that the first 2 years of this pilot project are going to focus primarily on development of standards and training. There's going to be very little, and some agencies representatives will come before you and intimate that they need to have hearings officers who have a particular expertise or knowledge of their industry or of their business. And that what they fear is that once this bill goes into effect, that there will be some magical person who will just reach into a bag and pull out a name, and they will get somebody completely different and new and naked in terms of their knowledge to the industry. That, at a minimum, is at least 2 years off. It's probably going to be longer off than that. If you think about the basic concepts of doing standardization and doing training for hearings officers so that you're developing a cadre of professionally trained hearings officers, that seems to run sort of contrary to the logic there. It will be a long time before you end up with new faces in any of these hearings. And the ones that we primarily focus on are the ones where the bulk of the hearings occur. They're in the Department of Motor Vehicles for license revocation. They're elsewhere in the Department of Transportation, the Oregon Liquor Commission hearings. That's what we found when we did a survey in the work group, the bulk of the hearings are. And then again, this other piece of taking boards and commissions out so the commissioners themselves are not hearing them. Representative Shetterly is correct. We realized that we were going through the work group and including and excluding agencies that we would end up with a similar situation that happened around House Bill 2948 last time, where we would have individual agencies or boards and commissioners coming in and asking to be let out because, as Representative Shirley put it, this is a great bill, we just want out of it. It's good for somebody else, it's not good for us. And we did take some care, but we decided at the end of it that we really needed to keep the folks that are in it and the folks that were out of it so that we can move forward. It's a 4-year pilot program. Any of the problems or the parade of horribles that you will probably hear this afternoon or maybe will hear on the Senate side are very unlikely to occur. If you notice in one section of the bill, there's the creation of a legislative oversight committee that has governor appointees as well as appointees from the Senate and the legislature. And their job is to work with this new chief hearings officer to see that the changes that occur happen in a way that doesn't just overly disrupt the orderly conduct of agencies and boards in the way they carry out their duties. So my suggestion to this committee is that there are adequate safeguards that are there to protect from wild or random acts occurring. I think it's going to be very deliberate. I think it's going to be very professional. Finally, as the lawyer for the executive branch, I'd like to sound a warning to the legislative members that you enter into this with your eyes open, that you understand what we are talking about here in terms of a historic trend. What this bill does is moves us towards a federal model of administrative law judges. Now, in the federal system, administrative law judges wield considerable authority. They actually have the ability to direct agencies to spend money in ways that they may not necessarily have budgeted for or wanted to do. And they're able to do that because they are treated like judges. In Oregon, we have had a different kind of system. And the administrative law judges at this point have not had that kind of authority. And one of the reasons that 2948 was vetoed last time was that it marked too far a move down that road too quickly from the governor's perspective. Particularly as the budget arm of the legislature, I think you need to think carefully about what this pilot program means for the future of government in Oregon if we, in 4 years' time, continue to go down this road. You will end up with a cadre of people inside of state government who are really answerable only to themselves, who may have the ability to direct agencies to spend money in ways that you haven't budgeted for and that the governor hasn't budgeted for. And that is an element of this that is maybe a little too macro to discuss all the time, but it certainly is an element of where we're moving. So as Representative Shirley said, this is an uneasy coalition that we have here. I understand the concern that agencies have in moving too far down this road, but I also understand the strength of the public perception that people may not be getting, and citizens may not be getting a fair shake when they come before a board or commission or have an administrative hearing. I think that this bill will give us an opportunity to see who's right. I think it will give us an opportunity to see whether we're going to save money. I think it's going to give us an opportunity to see whether there's this pent-up demand out there for independent hearings officers. And I think it's going to let us see whether or not we get a better product with professionally trained hearings officers to put future legislatures in a position to decide that the important policy, underlying policy piece I pointed out before, is whether or not we want to move down this road to having an independent judiciary inside of government that can make decisions that right now are left to the government and the legislature.
Chip, question for you. In dealing with this issue of administrative law judges that may be able to decide certain budgetary issues solely and apart from us in the Ways and Means process, is that constitutional?
Well, it is to the extent that agencies are going to have to follow the law. And if you move further down this road in having administrative law judges making a determination as to what the law is and how the agency must follow it, yes, I think it will be constitutional.
And one other question. You mentioned that the 4-year pilot project, the first 2 years, we're focused on standards and training, so then the implication is the last 2 years then will be actually the implementation of trained professional hearings officers that will be utilized across a broad range of issues.
Of the affected agencies.
Of the affected agencies.
Right. And I think representatives in the Mr. Chair, in the first first 2 years, you're going to see a claim that's made by the chief hearings officer that's mentioned in the bill. But I think you're going to see 98-99% of the time it's the same faces that the practitioners have seen all along, whether it's Liquor Commission hearings or Department of Transportation hearings, just simply because there isn't going to be the time to get the training in place.
Okay.
To make those changes, and so that'll be a gradual piece. I think sort of a two-part answer. Yes, in the first 2 years, we expect the chief hearings officer to make these assignments. It won't be just simply the person in the agency deciding who it's going to be. The chief hearings officer will do that, but as a practical matter, they're going to be the same.
Okay.
What sort of an appeals process will there be from the independent agency once the hearing has been determined?
We took a brief look at changing the standard of review for administrative hearings and decided that was really a standalone issue. And what we have done in lieu of changing the standard of review, which Representative Chevrolet accurately described as substantial evidence in the record before the Court of Appeals as to whether or not the agency followed its own rules. Instead, what we have done is we have institutionalized what we started calling in the work group a sunshine provision, whereas before you would go in and have a contested case hearing and the hearings officer would prepare a proposed order, a proposed final order to the agency. And sometime later, the agency would issue a final order, and sometimes people got caught in that and said, well, gee, you know, I had the hearings officer going one way, and I felt that this is all the, and now here comes this agency order that seems to be the exact opposite of that. Now what we've done is the proposed order becomes a part of the record, and to the extent that the agency wants to change facts in there, there's a new standard of proof there. But that change from the proposed order has to be put into the record. The agency has to specify what it is in the record that they're relying on in order to do that. Now, Mr. DiLorenzo and I have had significant conversations about what to do about this substantial evidence on the record. Both of us as lawyers recognize that that's a very steep burden for an appellant to meet. If the agency only has to show that there's substantial evidence to record support what it is that we want to do, it's very difficult for you to make out a case that we should have done something different. But I submit to you, and as I submitted to Mr. DiLorenzo, that you really need to, that's a standalone issue. You've got to get the courts involved in that. You've got to decide where you're going to bring that. If you're going to make the court second guess what the agency is doing, then Representative Crop, you do run to the constitutional issue.
Another sort of a statement, maybe you can just reflect on. One is, it seems like that this is a fairly giant pilot program, and that the kinds of steps you have to take to implement it, the costs involved and everything else, is a kind of a fait accompli that would be very hard to undo if you decided it didn't work. And so it seems to me that one ought to be very, very sure this is what you want to do to begin with, because you're likely to be stuck with it, whether you call it a pilot program or not.
Well, I agree with you. I understand that it's more difficult to undo things around here sometimes than it is to get things done. You know, the feelings around this issue, especially from last time, were very, very strong on both sides of this. And we struggled through the whole interim, my work group, which had representatives from the legislature as well as big and small agencies and some outside folks. We were unable to reconcile that. So the thought is that if this idea really is that bad, you know, you're going to know it in 2.5 years' time, and people are not going to be eager to go any further with it, and they'll undo it. If it's too expensive, if it's too cumbersome, if it leads to uneven results, I mean, there's a variety of criteria I think the legislature can use in returning to this issue next time. But if, you know, if it turns out to be more efficient, and if it turns out that it is beneficial, Representative Chevrolet is fond of saying agencies will be dying to get involved in it.
Perhaps we'll have the opportunity to hear from them later in that regard.
I think you're going to hear the exact opposite number.
Representative Butler has a series of questions, and Representative Butler.
I just had a question relative to local governments, I know, are using alternative dispute resolution techniques. Has the state ever considered doing that?
We talked about alternative dispute resolution, and in fact, House Bill 2948 had an alternative dispute resolution portion in it. You have to consider, I think, Representative, the nature of these disputes. The folks from Department of Human Resources pointed out to us in the work group, by the time you get to a contested case hearing, you've gone through all those dispute resolution pieces. Your issues are like this, and for the record, I have one hand vertical, one hand horizontal. I mean, you really are at odds with one another, where you have one individual saying the light was red and the agency saying the light was green, and the only thing to do is order the fact and have the agency apply its rules.
Okay, that having been said, then, let's talk about the appearance. Does the taxpayer, one of our constituents, really think that the Oregon State Central Hearings Officer who draws his or her pay and salary from the state of Oregon is really that much different from a hearings officer from the blank commission or state agency?
Well, Representative Butler, I think the concerns are a little more specific and a little narrower than that. I mean, by that logic, how can a person expect to receive justice from a judge who's paid by the state of Oregon as well? The concern was much narrower than that. It was, how can I get justice before the Department of Human Resources when I'm trying to get an extension on my benefits when the hearings officer is paid for by the Department of Human Resources? I feel like I'm going up against them, and they're sitting on their money, so how can the agency end up saying they're going to give me more money? I need somebody that doesn't answer to these folks for their paycheck in order to achieve some semblance of fairness. And so it isn't generalized to the state representative, it's generalized to agencies. Now, by stating that position doesn't mean necessarily that I believe that that's true in all cases. My sense of the testimony we got during the work group and from my associations with these hearings officers is that these people have a lot of integrity and a lot of professional pride. And if they think that the agency's wrong, they're going to write a proposed order that says that way, and it's reflected in the record. But it's that perception that still persists on the part of some citizens that the paycheck controls everything else. This is an attempt to sort of, if you will, uncheapen the process.
And I guess that brings up your issue, Mr. Chair, of the follow-up there, of the potential of the administrative law judge direction that we're headed. And I guess I would ask Mr. Brennan that if we do proceed with this kind of a program, that we make absolutely certain that this cadre of professionals, dispute resolution folks from the Central Hearings Panel, would not be permitted to resolve disputes outside of the budget parameters that would be given to any agency if it's one of the state agencies that's over one of our health agencies that it couldn't award an amount in excess of what is either available or could be made available through the emergency board process so that it couldn't bankrupt the state agency in effect. And I think that would be inappropriate, because it sounds like that really we are moving towards the administrative law judge direction in that regard, and that could be our mandate.
Federal government administrative law judge, Representative Weber, can make rulings such as that, and it's just something that caution the legislature about as we move down this road. I think we're 3, 4, maybe 5 sessions away from that, but certainly it's not too early to start thinking about it.
Thank you very much for your answer.
Thank you.
Chip, I see that the chief hearing officer needs to be an attorney, but I don't see anything with respect to the hearings officers being required to be.
Correct. Representative Leonard, we looked at the question of whether or not these hearings officers should be lawyers. There are a number of fine hearings officers out there right now, David Marcus and some others, who are not lawyers. And again, it comes back to this whole distinction between contested case hearings and going into a court of law. There's a different type of expertise that's necessary where a legal degree is not necessarily required, and I'm sure many people think that a JD impairs you to a certain extent.
I just wonder if we could expand that to other areas as well.
Well, you know, it represents that you and I have talked about this before, and I'd be happy to do a job share with you. But it was thought that the chief hearing officer should probably be an attorney because of the heavy legal lifting that's going to go on in terms of
interfacing with the Department of Justice, developing the overall standards, the training that's necessary. We had an excellent presentation during my work group from Justice Gillette, who laid out the training for administrative law judges at the Judicial College in Reno, Nevada does, and some of the things that are available there. So it was kind of a compromise. There's some people that thought they should be lawyers. I think the general sense was it isn't necessary, but the chief security officer should be because of all the complex legally based decisions that are going to have to be made in the first 2 years.
Yes, and I appreciated your explanation about transitioning in who the hearings officers will be given their background and expertise. But I do note that there's some widely different boards and commissions that are going to be using hearings officers. For example, the Employment Relations Board, which I've had some experience with, and then the Public Utility Commission right after it, I would imagine the issues are quite different.
I think you're looking at the excluded list representation.
These are the.
I think it's
primarily I'm not going to apply for the hearings officer position.
Don't confuse me. We can arrange.
I was on a road trip. I wish you wouldn't do that. Okay, how about the Water Resources Department?
Correct.
And then just say OLCC. What then? After a couple of years of training, what are the individuals that will be able to handle these hearings be trained for expertise in those various departments? Or are you going to try to get a cadre of hearings officers for each subject area and only use them for that subject area?
I think there will be a base of professional training that goes on in this. And then I think there will be opportunities for people to become cross-trained in some of these disciplines. And I can't imagine that occurring without consultation from these different agencies. With respect to the Water Resources Department, when we did our survey in the work group of what happens in these contested case hearings, we found that Weisha Mize over at the Water Resources Department was the last of the in-house administrative law judges, and that what all the other natural resource agencies did when they had this particular type of narrow case, they would call the employment department and ask for a hearing officer, or they would contract out with somebody to come in and conduct a hearing for them. So we found that there was already a de facto central panel existing in the side of state government. But again, I can't imagine the training piece of the training and standards part being such that it wouldn't be done in consultation with the agency so that people are up to snuff on the particulars of what goes on. I agree with you. Water is a very confusing issue. But
the idea then is, if I can follow that up, then is even with that kind of contact and training, there'll be more separation between the agency and the hearing officer than there is currently.
I think that correct is the general idea, is so that they're less in-house and that they're more sort of professionally coming in and handling hearings. Correct.
Any further questions? Chip?
Not Chip, thank you very much for coming and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, sir.
We have two other individuals signed up to testify, Mr. Grattan Cairns. If you'd like to come forward at this time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Cairns, representing the Oregon University System, being distributed to you is a proposed amendment to House Bill 2525. So we begin by saying that, like the other 121 agencies who went through the process 2 years ago and through the work group, we were waived off early and from an exemption and respected that, of course, and have been absent from the process for many, many, many months as it progressed. However, this language does come to you today because I offered it to Mr. Lazenby, who said that he had no objection to it and thought that it could be incorporated in the bill and not upset the balance that he spoke to. As a result of his thumbs up, or green light, if you wish, the Department of Justice, who has also seen the language, has no objection, has concurred with Chair Shenerly and with Chair Bryant, and both of them concur, as you heard Chair Shenerly say, that he had no objection to it and thought that that was a reasonable amendment to make. let me confess a terrible mistake on my part, which brings a procedural a substantive amendment to the bill to a Ways and Means Subcommittee. I took that wave off, as did everybody else, as to be a complete bar to consideration, and it wasn't until it dawned on me that we could in fact bifurcate the question that I came forward with this language. It's a work in mistake on my part, but with the agreement of both chairs, the Governor's Office and the Department of Justice, and with your positive consideration amendment, I may recoup that loss. I would have taken it to the joint hearings of the Judiciary Committee had I realized my mistake earlier, but the chairs have graciously allowed me to come forward. The university system does not believe that it's different, and like other agencies, that it's good for somebody else and not us, but rather that we are traveling in on a different plane. This legislature 4 years ago adopted Senate Bill 271, the Higher Education Efficiency Act, granting us a fairly broad scope of powers outside of the state statutes governing personnel, contracting, purchasing, etc. And in this session, you have adopted Senate Bill 163, which has passed both the Senate and House committees without opposition and passed both chambers without opposition and has been signed by the governor, which, and I'll quote the summary, allows State Board of Higher Education and State Institutions of Higher Education to establish adjudicative procedures as an alternative to procedures required by the Administrative Procedures Act. I wanted to hold on to my quarter. I did not say APA. This is an extension of our work under the Higher Education Efficiency Act to allow for those kind of dispute alternative dispute resolution processes, to create a cafeteria model, if you will, to have the adjudicative process fit the case and the persons who are affected by it. With the amendment which we're offering under House Bill 2525, we would then be completely consistent with both the Higher Education Efficiency Act and your earlier action on Senate Bill 163 by granting to the department its continuing jurisdiction over intra-campus matters and leaving us subject to the process of House Bill 2525 in our relationships with the outside world. Let me speak just very briefly about what those intra-campus questions might be. The bulk of them are in student conduct. You can make your own decision of whether we need to call Salem, get the Department of Employment to get a hearings officer into the car down the campus and hear a disorderly conduct question which falls under the campus adjudicated procedure for a Saturday night altercation. We think it's probably best to allow the system to treat that in the way it does now. In addition, there's an extreme case, a town patron who has a town patron card or a library and has excessive overdue library fines and under our processes has the ability to seek adjudication, is not something you think would fall under this. And third, as Chair Shetterly said, and we certainly agree, we wouldn't have made the top 30 hit parade of people that of agencies people were looking for when they wrote this either the first time or now the second time. There is, however, one fundamental thing that is extraordinarily important and which is different, and that is issues of faculty discipline. We operate under a process of shared governance. All universities do. It is extraordinarily important for the accreditation process and for the integrity of the university that it has that, and that's the case, that the faculty senate and its processes be respected. This, as written, of course, would put those issues before these hearing panels, and we think that while they could be resolved that way, and we would certainly have to stand by the outcome, we think it's probably better to respect the tradition of the university and allow those faculty questions to be cited in the usual way. I'm glad to answer any questions you may have, and again, I beg your indulgence and offer my apologies for not having brought this in the subject committees and had to burden you with the issue today, but the four green lights and your approval, I'll be out of your hair and promise to try not to make that mistake again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lewis.
Grattan, who in the Department of Higher Ed would be the hearings officer currently if he had, for instance, a dispute with a student?
The chairman, Representative Leonard, at the first instance, would be under the student government and their student conduct court. And
but so the appeals.
The appeals then are in. Persons who are affected by it. With the amendment which we're offering under House Bill 2525, we would then be completely consistent with both the Higher Education Efficiency Act and your earlier action on Senate Bill 163 by granting to the department its continuing jurisdiction over intra-campus matters and leaving us subject to the process of House Bill 2525 in our relationships with the outside world. I would speak just very briefly about what those intra-campus questions might be. The bulk of them are in student conduct. You can make your own decision of whether we need to call Salem, get the Department of Employment to get a hearings officer into the car down to campus and hear a disorderly conduct question which falls under the campus adjudicated procedure for Saturday night's altercation. We think that probably best to allow the system to treat that in the way it does now. In addition, there's an extreme case, a town patron who has a town patron card to our library and has excessive overdue library fines and under our processes has the ability to seek adjudication is not something we think would fall under this. And third, as Chair Shetterly said, and we certainly agree, we wouldn't have made the top 30 hit parade of people that of agencies people were looking for when they wrote this either the first time or now the second time. There is, however, one fundamental thing that is extraordinarily important, and which is different, and that is issues of faculty discipline. We operate under a process of shared governance. All universities do. It is extraordinarily important for the accreditation process and for the integrity of the university that it has that. And that's the state, that the Faculty Senate and its processes be respected. This, as written, of course, would put those issues before these hearing panels, and we think that, they could be resolved that way, we would certainly have to stand by the outcome. We think it's probably better to respect the tradition of the university and allow those faculty questions to be cited in the usual way. So glad to answer any questions you may have. And again, I beg your indulgence and offer my apologies for not having thought this in the subject committees and had to burden you with the issue today, but with four green lights and your approval, I'll be out of your hair and promise to try not to make that mistake again.
Thank you, Mr. Cairns. Representative Leonard.
Grattan, who in the Department of Higher Ed would be the hearings officer currently if you had, for instance, a dispute with the student?
The chairman, Representative Leonard, at the first instance, would be under the student government and their student conduct court. The appeals then are internally, ultimately going to the university president through the, depending on the campus and their rules, it could go to the student life and then on to the president. The president then resolves the matter.
And that's the end of the appeal for the student, would be with the university president?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, I'm not confident to answer that question. I do know that a student who is aggrieved has the right of civil action, and they do avail themselves of that, but as parallel cases. But I'm not sure what their appeal process would be beyond the president.
You gave an example of a student that might be in trouble because of some extracurricular activity. What about a student that was alleging some kind of institutional racism?
Mr. Chairman, those aren't something where the Representative Leonard, where the students would be able to bring the institution itself before its own bar of justice. He wouldn't be able to. That would be something that you would have to take up extrajudicially.
But what if the issue was grades? The student alleges his grades or her grades were what they were because of some institutional racism.
The chairman,
what the student had that he was getting a fair hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, if the case went against a faculty member, then that would be heard in the present process, and a student would then be able to take that case against a faculty member. But if the opposite question, which I think you're asking in terms of institutional bias or a generalized lack of institutional sensitivity to something, that is would be taken up either to the president or to the board, and would be taken up ultimately here in the legislature.
Fair one further. And this language also covers employees of the Department of Higher Ed, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so an employee currently has what appeals process that they feel that they have some, what kind of a process is there within the institution to say U of O for an employee who has an issue that this bill under its current language would change?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, the present process would be a contested case hearing, an appeal from that to the president, an appeal from that to the chancellor's office, and an appeal from there to the state board, and from there to the Court of Appeals.
That would be an example of the kind of issue that's currently appealed in that process that would be appealed with the hearings officer under the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, cases relative to faculty are extraordinarily rare. Literally extraordinarily rare.
They're mostly represented, aren't they? They're mostly represented.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, no. We have representative faculty on the Portland State University campus, Western Oregon University, and Southern Oregon University in a professional association, but they make up the smaller part of the tenured faculty. So most of the faculty are unrepresented.
They have some kind of an internal appeals process to resolve pay disputes or disciplinary disputes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, that's correct. They, as I say, those are fairly rare, and the ones that come in relative to faculty are, frankly, extraordinarily sensitive. I've had experience with only one, and it was extraordinarily difficult. I can't imagine how it would have been helped by the process being proposed. It was satisfactorily settled, but not as a result of the adjudicative process.
Sure. I guess I can imagine some reason that there might be few contested cases if a faculty member that's disciplined is then appealing to the body that disciplined him and her.
so I could imagine there are very few contested cases. It would seem like to be a waste of time.
Well, Mr. Chairman and General Leonard, I would respectfully disagree. The fact of the matter is that most of matters that come as a result of disputes are settled collegially within a department or within a college. These are matters which can run a fairly wide gamut, but virtually all go to the issue of how a individual faculty member may or may not be conducting themselves in the furtherance of their professional obligations, and those matters are, in almost all cases, settled without going to a question of adjudication.
No further questions or Karen, thank you very much for coming. At this time, we'll call John Mangle. Thank you for coming. Please state your name for the record.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Mangus, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'm not here to list reportables or anything like that, although our bond counsel has expressed some concern with the department's loan program being part of this administrative hearings process. And with the governor's permission, I have been allowed to negotiate with Mr. Lazenby and Representative Shadowy to try to get ourselves exempted. But the question I have today, or comes to mind, is the on financing of the panel as it's developed. And as I read the legislation, it reads in some instances to me that they may have the power to assess an agency for the services provided. And I just wanted it to be on the record that there is an Attorney General's opinion in 1986 on the assessing of dedicated funds, such as the Oregon War Veterans Fund, and there's several other funds that are dedicated, but, you know, constitutionally. And on the case with the Secretary of State, when they do their annual audits with the department, they spend probably 7 to 8 months a year in our auditing our loan program, whereas they used to use an assessment until that AG opinion was issued. They now go, and it's time and expenses that they have to bill us for. And they were not happy with that. That's the way it is. So I don't know what impact that has on 2525. It might be of interest to somebody to look at it. And other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. But that's it.
John, when you used to assess, am I hearing you correctly saying that since you've changed the manner in which you're doing that now because of the AG's opinion, Attorney General's opinion, excuse me, see, I caught myself, that it hasn't been positive for you, it's actually cost your agency more money in that particular regard?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman. In the past, like the Secretary of State would basically estimate what the costs of their audits are going to cost statewide and how much money they're going to have to run their agency, and then that would be divided up. We were a heavy work agency because of the amount of debt that we service, and we would just be assessed a certain amount. After the Attorney General's opinion came through, where they could only bill us on their time and expenses while they're doing the audit, our costs dropped dramatically. And the same with the state library provided an assessment. We couldn't pay that, but now we contract separately at a substantial less amount.
Are you concerned that there's language in the proposal that would allow for assessments as opposed to some other more perhaps accurate form of funding?
And as far as a dedicated fund goes, and I may not be reading it correctly, but I wouldn't want them to think that they could assess us. They would have to, if we are required to use this program, then it would be strictly on time and charges. And
where is the particular area that is
Section 15, page 5 on the A and Gross.
Well, it certainly seems to appear that there's a
open door there, I think, for interpretation of that issue based on that wording.
Now, we're still, Mr. Chairman, working with Mr. Lazenby as far as trying to get ourselves exempted because of the nature of the program and the fact that certain decisions could cause certain bond issues to become taxable. If that comes, that could create quite an interesting situation for the state as far as credit rating and lawsuits from individual bondholders. So, but we've only had six contested case hearings, I think, since 1966. We usually settle everything with an informal hearing.
How many cases, sir?
Six contested.
Since 1966?
1996.
96, I'm sorry.
Generally, we're able to work things out in an informal process where, you know, we don't have a full-time hearings officer. We have an individual assigned the hearings officer as an additional duty because we have so few of them. But we're trying to be consistent on the decisions that are made fair. But in no case do we want to violate any of the tax laws that impact that program. Basically a screwed up program to begin with.
Well, we appreciate your practice. Well, if there are no questions of Mr. Magnus, thank you, sir. We appreciate you coming. And we have Fred Venata. If you'd like to come forward, Fred.
How do you do? I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. I am not here with the approval of the governor, at least at the moment, although negotiations are still ongoing there, but in part because the distinguished chair of the Judiciary Committee referenced the issue with the Construction Contractors Board and because of the financing. There are a couple of reasons I wanted to call your attention to. First, to the substance of the issue, the Construction Contractors Board handles two kinds of cases. One type of case is the disciplinary case that Representative Shatterly so eloquently described and for which this bill is introduced. We support keeping the Construction Contractors Board in the bill for those cases. They constitute about 10% of the cases the Construction Contractor Court has are, in effect, disciplinary cases or enforcement cases against registered contractors. The rest of the cases are what might be called, or what we call, two-party cases. And those are the disputes between a customer and a contractor. And the Construction Contractors Board, one of their principal purposes is to assist in resolving those disputes. The bad news is this bill, as drafted, includes those cases. The exact history of how that came to pass isn't entirely clear. The Construction Contractors Board was excluded from the legislation last time because of these two-party cases. And when they drafted the bill this time, they put the Construction Contractors Board in and didn't separate the kinds of cases I won't speculate beyond that, but we are here at the moment without the blessing of the governor to remove these two-party cases. There are some, that's one of the issues, and so the hearing officers, the Construction Contractors Board has at present, you asked about alternative dispute resolution. Construction Contractors Board doesn't hire any hearing officers now except those that have extensive training in mediation and arbitration, because it is also possible if the contractor and the customer have an arbitration clause in their contract that the issue may be arbitrated. we lose, ultimately, we lose that special training in construction dispute resolution that the customers and the contractors presently have access to under this process. So that is one issue. The other issue is that the bill moves the entire section of the Construction Contractors Board to this new agency. There are presently six bodies in that section, and they do work other than the final stages of dispute resolution. It's my presumption that somewhere in the process, assuming you don't do the right thing and take all those cases out, and you leave the Construction Contractors Board fully covered, you do need to focus on this movement of personnel. As I understand it, there's about a $450,000 added cost to the Construction Contractors Board, which is the equivalent of about a 10% increase in our registration cost. I, for one, don't really care to go back to my folks and say, we have brought you a new dispute resolution process that nobody believes will work as well as the one you've got now, and by the way, you get to pay an additional 10% for it. But you can significantly mitigate the added cost by not moving the entire section, as the bill appears to do now, but only move part of the section. Still, if we understand the way it's proposed to finance is, they would move the employees that are doing the hearing officer from the Construction Contractors Board to the agency. The hearings, the Construction Contractors Board would continue to pay their salaries and pay an additional $25,000 in employee move for administrative costs and the cost of setting up the agency. Now that was how it was explained to me that the process was going to be financed. So we would be, even under those cases, paying somewhere $100,000 or more additional expenses for being involved in the process. And I want to flag that issue for you, and I'd be happy answering questions that you might have.
Fred, what was that $400,000 based on? Where did that figure come from?
It's my understanding that, and unfortunately I don't have it here. I thought there would be somebody from the agency perhaps here and bring it. But it is, there are six employees, I understand there are six employees in the agency that in the hearing officer process that would be moved. Only about four of them, about the work equivalent of two FTEs, are do other work within the agency. They're in the they're in the dispute resolution process before it becomes before it would be triggered by before it goes to the independent hearing officer. If you move all four of them away and you're requiring to pay, but you're requiring the Construction Contracting Board to pay for them, the Construction Contracting Board then got to hire two more folks to do the work that they don't have those folks to do. Plus, they've got to pay for six. They've got to pay the SPIF, if you will, for moving six employees into the central agency. And the SPIF, as I understand it, was calculated to be about $25,000 a head. And that's how you get to the $400, give or take, $1,000 in additional cost. If I understand it correctly, I have none of the documents in front of me on it.
Yeah. Do you have anything from LFO yet on the... I've looked at my stuff here now.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, we haven't handed anything out on the fiscal impact of this bill yet. In the governor's recommended budget, the Construction Contractors Board did have to pay, or would have been paying, another $155,000, which is $25,000 divided or times the six FTE.
Over and above the current budget?
Yes, that's correct. But that is not unique to the Construction Contractors Board.
Are we going to get an analysis?
Further questions of Fred? Fred, we thank you very much, and you only owe us a quarter because I caught you on full-time equivalent. You did very well with construction contractors board.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
That's perfectly all right. We appreciate the donation.
Thank you for the business.
Is there anyone else who would like to, General, please come forward if you'd like.
She's been ready to pull out of her chair.
To let you know, we will not go into work session today, obviously. First of all, we don't have a quorum, number one. And number two is we would like to leave the opportunity open for as many individuals as possible to speak on this issue. We will continue the public hearing tomorrow and then probably will move into a work session tomorrow. That's the expressed desire of the chair earlier to me. So, General, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Jenna Ingram, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. The Oregon Association of Realtors opposed including the real estate agency into the similar bill that was introduced last legislative session. And I just wanted to remind the committee, the subcommittee, of conversations that we had in this room back on January 28th when the real estate agency's budget came forward. And at that time, the legislative fiscal officer spoke about a negative impact that the budget might have if House Bill 2525 should pass. At that time, members of the committee were questioning what the cost impact might be, and I testified at that time that we had not seen the cost impact. However, the bill last year would have impacted the real estate agency's budget an additional approximately $264,000, which was unbudgeted at that time. And again, we have not seen what the cost impact will be this time. However, we are convinced that it will have a definite negative impact on the budget of the real estate agency. We understand that in order to make this program work, the various proponents want to group together lots of people to help pay for it because it is going to be very costly. We understand as well that there's going to be a duplication of efforts because the real estate agency will be able to overrule the ALJ panel or the individual ALJ, I'm sorry, administrative law judge. Can overrule on the evidence, which means that the real estate commissioner, who is now the hearings officer, is going to have to follow the facts of the case anyway. So you're going to have a duplication of effort. The attorney general representative to the agency has also indicated that due to the duplication of services, there will be additional costs to the agency. We have estimated, and again, we have not seen any figures from the Legislative Fiscal Office, that we're predicting that if this bill passes with the real estate agency in it, there will be an additional cost of approximately $11 per member for our members for their licenses. We're sorry that some agencies have a taint about them, if you will, as was alluded to, that there is some unfairness going on or there's the appearance of unfairness. However, that has not been the case with the real estate agency. Our commissioner keeps an arm's length stance from all cases that for which he may hear at a later time. In fact, I was in the Judiciary Committee hearing room when the commissioner was going to testify on another bill, and someone came up and wanted to speak with him about a case that, or a situation that there was an ongoing investigation, and the commissioner very politely said, well, I'm sorry, I can't discuss that with you at this time because, as it turns out, I may end up being the hearings officer on that case, and I cannot discuss it. The real estate agency has not had the sorts of problems that you've heard about. We also were excluded, as were our members, from the interim work group. There's been no evidence that we can see as to why the real estate agency should be included. It seems like you're being asked to go forward blind on this bill, not knowing what the cost impact will be, and really not knowing any, you know, what the need is, from at least our perspective, for real estate licensees and the real estate agency. With that, unless there are additional questions, I will close at this time.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see you. Well, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2525 today. I want to thank John Britton from the Legislative Council and Jamie Fenn for working with us today. And we will open again tomorrow. Thank you.
as to why the real estate agency should be included. It seems like you're being asked to go forward blind on this deal, not knowing what the cost impact will be, and really not knowing any, you know, what the need is, from at least our perspective, for real estate licensees and the real estate agency. With that, unless there are additional questions, I will close at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see you. Well, we will close the hearing on House Bill 255 today. I want to thank John Britton from Legislative Council and Jamie Fenn for working with us today. And we will open again tomorrow. Thank you.